I will not revoke its punishment because they reject the law of the Lord and have not kept his statutes. Their lies also have led them astray, those after which their fathers walked.
Amen. Preach the word, brother.
Well, thank you. Good job, John. And it's so good to see all of you this morning, and even some of you that I haven't met yet. And I hope we can fix that after services this morning. Of all the people who are glad to see Sharon back with us this morning, I think I'm at the head of the line. I think you know that we've been away for nearly 3 months down in Houston, and there were a lot of days that we didn't know for sure that we'd both be coming back. And through all of that time, your prayers sustained us. And your cards and your letters and your emails and coming to visit us and sending us things made the difference. And there are limitations to what doctors can do. And Sharon reminded them of that a time or two. Your prayers brought us through. So today, you're going to wonder. So the elders invited me back and they said, well, Dan's going to be gone. Maybe you'd like to share a message with us. And there is something that I've been thinking about a lot lately as I've had a lot of time to think. And you might wonder if Dave Smith and I had gotten in cahoots on this and we were going to talk about the same thing as you hear what I have to say. But no, I think it must have just been a God thing. Because, you know, as late as 10 o'clock last night, I was thinking, well, I wonder if this is the sermon that I want to share. But I think maybe it is. I'll take it as a sign. And if I'm wrong, you can tell me later. I want to talk about seduction. You know, seduction is a thing that I don't know if I've ever really heard us talk that much about it in the church. We talk about some things around it, but do we really talk about being seduced as individuals and as a body? Now, as I talk about this, this is not some accusation that I'm bringing against the church here in this place or anybody that's here, at least not in particular, not any more than you would any person that you met anywhere. All of us are people who are subject to seduction. The church has always been, and God's people have always been, subject to seduction. And that's why I'd like to talk about it. First, let's consider the word, seduce. You know, it's an old, old word that comes to English from French, and it came to French from Latin. And the word literally means to lead astray. Fairly common meaning. And is that the meaning that connects with you? There are three different main uses of this word in our modern English use. And in every one of them, it has to do with persuading someone to do something that they would not do. That is, that their insides, their conscience, their thoughts would tell them, their training would tell them, I shouldn't do this. Seduction is all about getting somebody to do something that they shouldn't. The first and the most common, what I'm sure comes to your mind first, is seduction that's sexual in nature. That is, causing somebody to have sexual relations where they wouldn't otherwise. The second is any activity that a person does that they would not do ordinarily. Especially this is a case if it involves being disobedient or disloyal. And the last one, which is the one that in some circles is presented as a positive thing, which is it's being won over to support some proposition that ordinarily you would not support. If you look it up in the thesaurus, it'll take you back to the word lure. And lure has its connotations. What do we use a lure for? For fishing, for catching, for snatching. And lure, you go back and look at the synonyms and you find words like tempt and entice and allure and attract and goad and spur and incentive, decoy, trap, entrap, snare, deceive, and lead astray. That's the kind of words that you find. And if you go back into the Scripture, you know, well, how often does the word seduce show up in Scripture? Do you see it really often? You probably don't. But guess what? There's a word that gets translated seduce sometimes, and it gets translated these other synonyms of seduce many other times, that occurs in four different words in the Hebrew Scriptures and in four different words in the Greek Scriptures. And if you want to know the Strong's numbers, and if you follow that sort of thing, see me later and I'll give it to you. But I won't go through that this morning. The first one is the one that gets used most often. It's something like ta in Hebrew. And it means literally to go astray. When you see it used in the Old Testament, it could be used to say stagger. When it talks about a drunk staggering into his own vomit, it's this word ta that gets used. It means to lead astray. When it says that the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, it's the same word. It means to be led astray, to not go where you should. A familiar passage, and I'll read one verse that I think you're familiar with, that uses this word, and it uses it and says, gone astray. It's Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 6. It says, all of us like sheep have gone astray. Each one of us has turned his own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. Another word that is used in the Old Testament that gets translated this way is patha. And this word is one that means literally open. And are any of you familiar with cattle? Who's familiar with cattle? If you say that I bought a heifer and she was open, what does it mean? She's ready to be bred. Okay? And it means that in this same sense. And so when it gets used in the text, it means susceptible. It means silly, simple, naive, seduced, enticed, persuaded, allured. A place where it's used in a verse that you would recognize is from the Law of Moses. This is Exodus chapter 22, verse 16. And it's translated seduced here. It says, if a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. See, shotgun weddings weren't invented in the hills. It was in the Law of Moses. And the word is there, seduced. Another word is sooth. This word is translated entice, incite, or mislead. And a passage that also I think you would recognize speaks about Ahab. This is in 1 Kings chapter 21, verse 25. It says of Ahab, surely there was no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of the Lord, because his wife Jezebel incited him. And it's the same word. The last Hebrew word is one that's something like mirha, and it means to use deceit, to beguile. It also, this is one that we have the same word in English and in Greek, because there's an Old Testament passage that was quoted in the New Testament. This is in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 22, and it's quoting Isaiah 53:9, and it's speaking of Jesus, and it uses the Greek word, which is doulos, and the Hebrew word, which is mira, in the two places in the Bible, and it says this about Jesus. It says, there was no deceit found in his mouth. It's the same word that Jesus used when he described Nathanael, and he said, a Hebrew indeed, in whom is no guile, or deceit, depending on your translation. And the last two words it's a word that, and I won't pronounce it right, and Sam, you can help me later, but it's plano or apoplano or something like that. And these are words that are related sort of like lure and allure and trap and entrap, that they're forms of each other that just change slightly different. It's the one that gets used most in the New Testament. There's a passage that I think you're familiar with. This is Jesus speaking, Matthew chapter 18. He said, and he translates it, it's translated gone astray. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep, and one of them is what? Gone astray. We know the story, don't we? Does he not leave the 99 on the mountain and go search for the one that is straying? So all of these words show up and they're translated in different ways, but they're throughout the Scriptures, the Old Testament Scriptures and the New Testament Scriptures. And accounts of seductions go from the very beginning to the very end. You find them in Genesis, you find them in Revelation. The first account of seduction is recorded in Genesis chapter 3. It's Eve and the serpent. And God asks Eve a question, and she replies, look in verse 13 if you're turned over there. She said, "The serpent deceived me, and I ate." The first seduction. And while we're here, we might as well make the point. You know, God acknowledged that she was seduced. She was tricked. But she still had to bear the consequences for what she did. So we have these words. They're all things that have universal meanings, that because the same thing happens in every culture, and every culture has its words, and they mesh. So they've got the same kind of thing, like love and hate. So they said that. And then that brings us to this business about warning against seduction. Has anybody ever warned you not to be seduced by things? Did your parents ever warn you? Did it make you mad? I mean, how many of us have either said or thought, why do you think just because you did something wrong when you were young that I will? Can anybody say that? I see some smiles. I think everybody. I don't think I ever said it to my parents, but I'm sure I thought it. And that's understandable. Because, you know, just because your parents did it, that's not proof that you will. But guess what? And look around. And look at the people that are older than you. And go up and ask them, have you done something when you were young that you've regretted the rest of your life? And see how many of them tell you no. It isn't proof as a young person that you will, but guess what? The odds are 1,000,000 to 1 against you. It isn't being young that causes a person to be a victim of seduction. That's not the cause. What causes a person to be a victim of seduction is thinking, it can't happen to me. Of thinking that you're invulnerable to it. Because when you start thinking that, guess what? No matter whether you're 15 or 51 or 115, it doesn't matter. When you start thinking that, you become easy prey. It's easy to capture you. And parents don't want to see their children captured. And that's why we always have this conflict. There are all of these warnings, and if you look in the book of Proverbs where this happens, where these warnings come more than any place else, you read things and, you know, if you look at chapters from 10 through 15, you see the same thing repeated over and over again. Chapter 10, verse 1, chapter 12, verse 1, chapter 13, verse 1, and all through chapter 15 it talks about, listen to the reproof from your parents. I'll just read something from verse 20 and from verses 31 through 32 in Proverbs chapter 15. I think this will be familiar to you. A wise son makes his father glad, but a foolish man despises his mother. Skipping down to 31, it says, he whose ear listens to life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. He who neglects discipline despises himself, but he who listens to reproof acquires understanding. You know, Gary Browning sent me a note not too long ago, and he said, you know, when I first met you, you were so much younger than me, even though the years weren't so different, that I still think of you as a mere child. And I wrote him back and reassured him, and I told him, I said, well, Gary, you know, I still think of you as an old guy. He gave up. So, and you know, Brother Archie, he didn't do it this morning. I figured he would, but just about every time he sees me, he says, how's it going, young man? Can you believe that? And I suppose from his perspective, that's me. And I still remember when I came and was quite wet behind the ears, and more than once or twice, you know, Brother Archie has taken me aside and put his arm around my shoulder and said, Ron, I don't believe I would have done that. And you know, I should listen to him, just like I should listen to my parents and my grandparents and all of the other people that have cared about me and my life. And no matter where you are, how young or old you feel like you are, that is still true for you forever. You become susceptible to becoming a victim when you start thinking that you can't be, no matter what your age. So as we look at the Proverbs, is that the only thing that tells us in Proverbs to look out for being seduced? Oh, not at all. I'll just hit some of the highlights for you. Chapter 1, it talks about being enticed to join in with evildoers. In chapter 11, it talks about being proud and boasting in oneself. In chapter 14, it talks about trusting in your own counsel. In chapter 6 and 12 and 24, all of these places talk about having lazy habits. Things that will get you. Temptations. Things that we're tempted to do. Chapter 10 talks about seeking ill-gotten gains. Have you ever wanted to have something just because you wanted it and it looked like it was easy to get? 11 talks about all sorts of things. False business practices, despising your neighbors, not being generous, trusting in riches. And chapter 12 is this long dissertation about getting all wound up and worrying about foolish things and saying things that later you regret. Have you ever said something? Have we ever said something that later we regretted? Oh, I think everybody has. Chapter 13 and 23 talk about spoiling our children. And if you really want to see an example of somebody who regretted spoiling his children, read the story of David and his sons. And then comes a big topic that gets talked about quite a bit. In chapter 20, 23, it talks about drunkenness. And you know, we live in an age and a time where we're not just drunkenness with alcohol, but also with all sorts of drugs are a problem. You know, the thing that I can't understand is why all of this upset is going on in the U.S. with the drug problems that are in Mexico, all of which are being caused by buying the stuff in the U.S. Have you noticed all of those places are where Mexico butts up against the U.S.? They're not the problem. We are. Listen to what this says about someone who drowns himself in wine. This is Proverbs 23, beginning of verse 29. Who has sorrow? Who has woe? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine. Those who go to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, and when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your mind will utter perverse things. And you will be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea, or one who lies down on the top of a mast. They struck me, and I did not become ill. They beat me, and I did not know it. When shall I awake? I shall seek another drink. It's not a new thing. It was true with them way back then. Proverbs goes on in chapter 16 through 20 to contrast the people who are trying to their best ability to do the right thing with people who are doing whatever they think they can get away with. Four whole chapters in Proverbs. Have you seen somebody recently brought down low by doing what he thought that he could get away with? It happens over and over again. But, as you might imagine, the most mentioned seduction in Proverbs is the one that Dave alluded to. It's sexual seduction. Chapters 5 and 7 are completely devoted to the topic, and it occurs throughout the rest of the book of Proverbs, these admonitions. And I don't think I can do better than what the writer of Proverbs did in describing it, so I'll just read you a little bit of chapter 5 and chapter 7. Chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, says this, "My son, give attention to my wisdom, and incline your ear to my understanding, that you may observe discretion, and your lips may reserve knowledge. For the lips of an adulteress drip honey, and smoother than oil is her speech. But in the end she is bitter as wormwood, and sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold of Sheol. She does not ponder the path of life. Her ways are unstable, and she does not know it." And picking up again in Proverbs chapter 7, beginning in verse 6. He says, "For at the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw the naive, and discerned among the youths a young man lacking sense. passing through the street near her corner, and he takes the way to her house. In the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness, and behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning at heart. She is boisterous and rebellious. Her feet do not remain at home. She is now in the streets and now in the squares and lurks by every corner. So she seizes him and kisses him. And with a brazen face she says to him, I was due to offer peace offerings. Today I have paid my vows. Therefore I have come out to meet you, to seek your presence earnestly. I have found you. I have spread my couch with coverings, with colored linens of Egypt. I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh, aloes, and cinnamon. Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. For my husband is not home. He has gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him. At the full moon, he'll come home. With her many persuasions, she entices him. With flattering lips, she seduces him. And suddenly, he follows her, as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as one in fetters to the discipline of a fool, until an arrow pierces through his liver. As a bird hastens to the snare, so he does not know that it will cost him his life. How many times has this been played out? You know, I wish this were only a message for young people, or only a message for people who are tempted to be seduced in this way, but you know it's not. Seduction takes on so many forms and has so many seducers, and every one of us are targets. The seducer may be some malicious person, some person that set on their intent to gain either wealth or power or sexual favors by taking advantage of us. That happens. Sometimes the seducer may be one of opportunity, someone who preys on the very young or the very old, or anybody who by their actions indicates that they think they're safe or at least don't realize that they're not. The seducer may be, and often is, someone who has been seduced themselves. And maybe they haven't realized the consequences yet. Or maybe they have, and they just want to get back for themselves what they already lost and by taking it from you. It happens all the time. They say, come join us. And here is the part that's a real shocker, but I think you'll know that it's true. The seducer may be you. Because you see, we seduce ourselves. Anytime that we convince ourselves that something is true, that we know that it's not, and we sit and we talk ourselves into anything. Have you ever sat and talked yourself into something? I know I have. Have we ever sat or stood in front of a mirror and said, how fine I look? That's seducing yourself. Have you ever spruced up a prized possession and stood back and just admired that you owned it? And I'm hoping Chevrolets are exempt here. But do you know what I'm talking about? This is taking pride in what you own. Have you ever gone over your financial accounts and thought, look at the wealth that I have accumulated and I'm going to be safe and secure in my old age? And when you think about that, maybe all of our 401ks turning into 201ks might have been a blessing. Taking security in the wrong things. And have you ever stood with your fellows, and it's whatever group that you might choose to stand with, it could even be all of us here together today. Have you ever stood with the people that you hold close and say, I'm part of that group, and stood and said, you know what? We are better than they. See, that's seduction. That's seducing yourselves. If you've ever sought to rationalize and justify yourself and what you thought or done, then you have been someone who seduced themselves. And sadly, it's not just an individual thing. It's not something that just individuals do. And this is where Dave was talking about, because whole people do it. God's people have done it over and over again. If you read in the scriptures and you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, where Samuel is there and his sons are not following his paths, and the children of Israel come to him and they said, we want a king. We want to be like the nations around us. We want to be just like everybody else. We want to put our trust in the government, not in our relationship with God. They started on that path. And they kept going after that path over and over and over again, and God kept sending them prophets. Hosea chapter 4, verse 12 says this, "My people consult their wooden idol. Their diviner's wand informs them, for a spirit of harlotry has led them astray. They have played the harlot, departing from their God." And even when God humbled them by the captivity and brought them back and set them back up in His land, He brought them back and He set them up to receive His Son. He sent His Son to save him. And what happened? They wanted an earthly king, and they rejected the spiritual king that came to save them. In Matthew chapter 23, we have this recorded. It's before Jesus went down into Jerusalem for that last week of His life. And He said, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I have wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. For I say to you that you will not see me until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" And the church followed the same path. We see it vividly in the early days, and we still see it today. Peter wrote about the things that would happen. Look at 2 Peter chapter 2, and I'll just read you a couple of verses out of it. But the whole of chapter 2 is talking about this same thing. It's talking about the people who would mislead and deceive and lead away the church. And he says, "But these are stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you, having eyes full of adultery that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed." And Jesus pronounced His condemnation on the people who would lead His innocents astray. And this word, this planeo, this Greek word, gets separated here. It's translated causes to stumble. And causes and to stumble get separated, but note that they're here. Here's what He says. Matthew chapter 18. "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he was drowned in the depth of the sea." So many times God's people have turned back to Him only to be seduced by the ways of the world, causing the church to go out and seek the things that human institutions seek. So, what are some examples in the church? You know, in 1846, there was a war. Some of you might not remember the war. I don't think Ward was around back then. But 1846, we had the Mexican-American War. And there was a prominent preacher in the Churches of Christ. His name was Tolbert Fanning. And he went and he stood up to President James Polk, who said that Christians should go and serve in this war. And he had a lot of other people that agreed with him that it was an unjust war at the time. But he's the one that stood up. He's the one that was arrested. He was the one who was tried for treason because he stood up to the president. And then in the Civil War times, when Abraham, in 1862, when Abraham Lincoln was setting the stage to start conscription, and Jefferson Davis, who was leading the other side, started the stage to do the same thing, Alexander Campbell is the one who confronted Abraham Lincoln. And David Lipscomb was the one who confronted Jefferson Davis and stood up and said, "This is not right that both of you will claim that you are just and right in what you're doing, and you'll tell our young men to go out and kill each other for you. This isn't about being just and right. This is about preserving you." So what happened since then? You know, somewhere between 1856 and 1956, something changed in the church. And you know, I've been reading the history about this, and it isn't that we studied the scriptures and became more enlightened. It is that our government went on a campaign to try to thwart this, to try to convince Christians that it's okay for you to take up arms and start killing people. That's what changed. So by the time I was a young man, we stopped being the ones to confront and started to be in the people who didn't even talk about it. Now, I'm not saying that I know what the answer to this is, but how does it happen that that transformation happened to us about what's right and wrong, and we don't even talk about it? Something changed. What did we trade for swallowing all of this just war propaganda? And if you think about this in the terms of Israel and the things that Dave shared a moment ago, what happened that made it wrong for Israel to trade serving and having alliances with government in exchange for protection and favors? What changed that made it wrong for them, and somehow now something changed and is right for us? I don't think it did. Something's not right here. I see the efforts in the church to organize the church and make it a religion, an organized religion that's following the denominational path, the same path that they did, with the purpose of either establishing new traditions or preserving the old ones, and with the same outcome either way, that the church is divided. And I see churches creating celebrities and then scheduling events and things that help those celebrities to bask and the church to bask in their glory. And I wonder if God came and He saw the books laid out that had the celebrity's name in big letters on the front cover, but you had to turn inside and look for a while to find Jesus' name on the inside, would He be pleased? I don't think He would. And what about establishing publishing houses and writers and academies and schools and colleges and universities that go from teaching the Scriptures to declaring themselves the magisterium, the people who have the right to interpret the Scriptures and reinterpret the Scriptures? What would happen if Peter came and saw people redefining what his words meant, the words that he suffered so much to deliver to us in the Scriptures? And what would Jesus say if he saw the churches? And I'll tell you this, is that this was quite an experience when we were in Houston, because the church where we worshiped was just a few blocks from a church that's really run like a business. That the church went out and bought what used to be a basketball stadium and converted it into a church. And it's run like a business. It's what is hot and what is popular and what will pack in the biggest crowd and raise the most money. How would Jesus feel about that if he saw our churches doing that? Glorifying in the superficial things of a worship service, making it little more than entertainment, instead of cultivating spiritual growth and service. You know, one of the things, and this is the part that comes closest to us, especially with our young people, it's so easy to be attracted to one of these mega churches. You know the kind of place I'm talking about? The kind of church where you just go in on Sunday morning and you sit down for 2 hours, you see a really good show and you go home and that's the end of it. It's really easy to be attracted to that. And it's not the kind of thing that's going to cause you to be a faithful Christian in the face of trials and adversities that come in life. We have to instill in our children spiritual growth and service, so that when they look at something like that, they say, oh, that ain't right. That's what we need to do. So how can these things be? And how can we as a brotherhood be seduced by these things? You know, do you know what the greatest seduction of all is? The greatest deceit, the thing that is the biggest lie that Satan wants you to believe? And he wants you to believe it, first of all, on the basis of you, yourself, personally. A great lie is that he wants you to believe, I can't do anything about it. He wants you to believe that you've been caught up in sin, or that you just can't help yourself of being seduced in all of these things. And maybe you already did it, and now there's nothing that you can do about it to straighten it back out again. And he wants you to believe the same thing for the church. He wants you to believe there's nothing I can do or say that's going to change things in the church. And those things are a lie. Jesus didn't come and live and die so that we could accept the status quo, the way things always have been. He made it possible for us to do things that are impossible by human means. He came and made it possible for you and I to do the hardest thing that there is possible for us to do, and that is to change ourselves inside. Not because we're so great and good, but because we can take Him on, and His clothing makes us clean. And once you have that, you can do anything. He died so that we could walk in the light. And here's what I want to suggest to you this morning is walking in the light. Walking in the light is being together with each other and disclosing what is inside of us so that there's nothing hidden and there's nothing that we're keeping from everybody else that's inside of us, especially about things like this. We need to be talking. You know, the ladies' Bible class needs to be talking about things like this. The men's Bible classes need to be doing it. And all of us in junior high and high school and every age level, and times besides when we're in formal Bible classes, we need to be talking about these things. Because if we don't, we're just acknowledging them, accepting them, and they'll go on forever just the way they are. So where does this leave you this morning, and where do you find yourself? Perhaps you're someone who has never become a Christian. And if you haven't put on that walk and started to walk in the light, being clothed in baptism by the blood of Christ, then all of this, although it makes a difference in how you live your life, doesn't save you. If you're a person who needs to become a Christian this morning, you know the church is here as we always are to invite you, to help you start in that walk. If you're a person who has been seduced by the cares of this world, and you personally have been carried away and drugged back into to the cares of the world for one reason or another, maybe things that we've talked about and maybe something that's completely different, something that I wouldn't understand. I understand what it is to have weakness. And so does everybody here. And the church is here for you there too. And if you're somebody who has been watching what's going on within the body, with the brotherhood in the United States, right where we are, and have been standing back and not saying or doing anything about it, you know, we're here for you too. Because this is a problem that I think all of us have. You can throw off the seduction of thinking you can't do anything about it. Because all three of these are things that you can. The church is ready. The elders are here to receive you. If you've got any kind of need today, or anything that I don't know and didn't mention, won't you come as we sing?